the Black Uncensored is absolutely not a YouTube-friendly show, although there is nothing actually wrong with it. Tom and Jared get into things most of the church would be afraid to cover. What you are watching now is a heavily edited version of the full episode in order to comply with YouTube's guidelines and standards. There are extremely important topics covered in the full version, things every Christian needs to know, that YouTube will not allow to be discussed. For the full version of this episode, become a member of Daily Renegade today by clicking on the link in the description below. Don't allow YouTube to tell you what you're allowed to watch, talk about, or think.
It's done.
Man, it's good to see you, Judd.
Hey, it's great to see you too, Tom. It's been like a year and a half.
A year and a half is exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
It has been, man.
We had a rocking time in South Texas.
I know. And nobody knows about it either.
That's right. It's
except for you and I.
It's very hush-hush.
It is. It is, man. Dude, I'm so excited that we could finally all get on here.
That has it ever happened? Has it ever happened?
It has not ever happened.
You've never done a show with Judd?
No. Okay.
I couldn't remember if there was at least one, but
yeah, Jared's about to tell you that it's a real treat.
It is. I wanted to say it really shows how much I like you, Judd, that I'd never bail on you like Tom does. So I just want that to I want that to keep us like a step of friendship above you and Tom always. Just think a little higher of me.
If we're gonna be honest here about who bails.
That'd be Judd.
That'd be me.
I'm just saying. I mean, if we're gonna have complete transparency.
Yep. I admit it. That's the crazy schedule of an academic.
That's fine.
Have you ever heard of the Mothman?
Absolutely. Joe Taylor is actually going to speak about the Mothman at the Sons of God conference. There have been
talk about that real quick. Pitch it.
The Sons of God conference?
Yeah, pitch it real quick.
Well, that's my Avengers initiative. The Sons of God Giants of Old conference is an outgrowth of the Institute of Biblical Anthropology, and that's we're in our seventh convocation. We're going to be meeting August the 16th and the 17th at the Fellowship Church there in Lubbock, Texas. And boy, we've got some heavy hitters this year. We've got Dr. Michael Heiser, Dr. Doug Hemp, Dr. Greg Reed, Derek and Sharon Gilbert, Joe Taylor, Dr. Aaron Judkins, myself. It just gets bigger every year. So if you want cutting edge research on the Watchers, the Giants, all manner of demonology, it's really a good value. The main tickets are $5 and the VIP package is $10.
Yeah, you can't beat that, so, dude, for the kind of world-class talent that you have there. That's insane. You wrote a new book, right?
I did.
I want to know about it because it's been a while since I delved into the Nephilim stuff. And is your book, is this book about the Nephilim? What'd you write?
It is. It's a book that I've put out and then had to pull back because I found more stuff. But it's essentially a sequel to Interview with the Giant. It's basically applying the same kinds of anthropological models, ethno-historical models, to the study of giants. And it reads like a collection of position papers. I cover a lot of different topics, like a prospective science of giantology, and or rather a prospective science of biblical giantology. I cover issues on why classical education has been jettisoned and what ramifications that has for an understanding the ancient world in general, but especially these beings that posed as the gods of antiquity. There's a chapter on the critique of the ancient astronaut hypothesis, and how most of the people that are pitching that and researching it are completely out of their depth. There it is.
Boom! Nailed it.
There's it. 10 years.
Is this why? you never have time for us because you're busy writing books all the time?
Man, it's what I do. You know, I get lost in the writing process. And you know, a lot of that had to do with, you know, just the duties of an academic, which I'm no longer a conventional academic. I'm devoting all my time and energy now to the Institute of Biblical Anthropology.
It's true. Now you're a quitter.
Yeah. I resigned my post at South Texas College. I've been praying about it. No. You know, and I think you and I had talked, we'd had some conversations about academia and learning in general. I think, Tom, the last time you and I spoke.
Yeah.
And, you know, God had been pulling me in that direction for quite some time. And, I just feel invigorated, about the direction that I'm taking. That's, you know, I sort of half jokingly called it my Avengers initiative, but it really kind of, you know, in an analogous sort of way, it is, you know, I'm not saying I'm Tony Stark or Nick Fury or anything. I'm just saying that, it's important to me to bring, more academic bearing, or more, I should say more scholarly bearing to some of these issues. And, I don't think anybody has really applied anthropological models to the study of giants and watchers like I have. But that's just, you know, that's one thing amongst many that the Institute will prospectively be doing. I've been gifted 5 acres to start building the brick and mortar operation. So it's been virtual for years, and I've taught classes through it. It's quickly becoming a reality.
You know, the subject of the Nephilim, it's what initially got me into Christian Fringe in the first place. And it's really sort of the bridge that a lot of people have had. You know, it's where entire new communities and an entire new branch of study inside the church has grown out of this subject of the giants in Scripture. And no matter where you go today in Christian Fringe, you always kind of come back to the idea of the Nephilim, because it's a central, mm-hmm. it's a central reality in Christian history, in biblical right. history, and you right. just can't get around it. And I haven't really gotten back into it in a while just because I've been in other topics, but lately sure. with some of the new UFO stuff coming out, it goes right back to the Nephilim. I'm like, you know, I really need to go back and refresh, you know, read some of the books that I've read in the past. Yours is on that short list just because it's super relevant in conversation. Mm-hmm. When I was in Roswell for the 4th of July festival this last weekend. And
yeah, that's a wild time.
Dude, it really is. It wasn't, I expected to see a lot more openly crazy people there, but it's kind of turned more into like live music and fair food.
Yeah.
But you still have, it still attracts certain groups of people. Like I met the Buddha Maitreya Monastery people, you know, that, mm-hmm. You know, out of California, they live on that planetary monastery that they have. Mm-hmm. I got to talk to them a little bit. I met a lot of people that were engaged in UFO research, obviously selling their books and stuff. But here's what surprised me. When I was going through the Roswell Art Gallery and looking at some of the art that private artists were selling, you know, they'd make an original and then sell prints. Dude, there was a lot of hybrid art. A lot yeah. of hybrid art. Yeah. And you and I both know, you know, the hybrid aspect of the Nephilim is very interesting today when you look at the subject of the return of the Nephilim. But, mm-hmm. you know, like Francis Schaeffer talks about in his trilogy, you know, you're reaching a significant point when an ideology reaches the art community. Because now mm-hmm. it really shows you how ingrained in the minds of people it is when it starts to be conveyed in the art. And you... Even though hybrid art is not necessarily mainstream, there was a whole bunch of it. And it was fascinating.
Yeah, well, when you, you know, it's been in the public eye through pop culture. You know, just think about all the, you know, all the, like the TV shows and, you know, Netflix series and things like that that have come out, you know, where that's either subtext to a plot line or it's just right in your face.
Yeah. The idea of mixing, you know, mixing yeah. with something,
yeah.
something else, you know, man. Yeah. That's definitely something that, pretty soon we're going to have an LGBTQP, A for alien in the not too distant future. We can have sex with aliens if we want, you know, we'll be pushing, we'll be pushing for normalcy there. Like, it's just... Yeah.
Exactly. This is what happens when postmodernism takes over your culture. It takes away objective truth or relegates it to the far periphery.
Well, it makes you susceptible to any truth claim, you know, that's actually, you know, some sort of initial fallacy. Yeah. So tell me about the new book. Okay. So it's kind of, it picks up, you know, on some of the same themes, your anthropological models of Interview with a Giant, but like, mm-hmm. where exactly do you go in this book? Like, give me some specifics.
Well, like I was saying, one of the big overarching ideas is the development of this prospective science of biblical giantology. And those of us that do research into the world of the Watchers and the Nephilim sort of do this implicitly. But an articulation of, you know, what exactly does that mean? What are such a discipline's parameters? What are... You know, what's, you know, is there a taxonomy that's involved, you know, terminology, that sort of thing. I'm trying to articulate that, or at least start to get a conversation going about articulating what exactly that looks like. At the last Sons of God conference, that was my presentation, and I summarized it essentially I flesh out some of those details in that chapter. It's actually one of the opening chapters, because when you think about we already have so-called conjectural sciences in mainstream academia. You know, we have astrobiologists.
That's something Tom wanted to bring up tonight on his bullet point list, was conjectural science. So make sure you get his commentary on that.
Yeah. What's up, Tom? What do you think of Tom?
I was playing with my green screen. What's going on? Did you guys say my name?
I said initially you told me that you wanted to talk about conjectural science with Judd. I didn't want you to miss the opportunity now that he's brought up conjectural science. So please share your thoughts.
Judd.
He's too busy. He's too busy stroking his John Petrucci beard.
All right.
That's a compliment, by the way.
It's a Francis Schaeffer beard.
Oh, okay, sorry. But you were rocking the John Petrucci look, by the way.
Yeah, well, I've always called it the Charles Manson beard. Compliment. I don't know, but that's just me.
That's Dream Theater, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Okay. I met that guy. Anyway, go ahead.
All right, conjectural science.
Long story. Go ahead.
Tom flunked out. Please continue.
Go ahead, Tom. What are you thinking?
Well, since you brought up Dream Theater, I got this story.
Okay.
That's double black belt level evasion right there, and it was masterful. Yeah. Tom, you deserve it.
Well, I did meet this guy, right? So, I have an old high school friend. He's actually best man in my first marriage, and a good guy. Apparently, I think he's a millionaire now. And he called me up and said, "Hey, I'm going to see Dream Theater in Cleveland, in Ohio. It's like backstage pass and second row and all this." And I was like, I'm not a big fan, but I'll go with you if you want me to. And we went up there and we met the band. And it's not that I don't like Dream Theater, it's just that I don't have any of their CDs. But there's a band called Theocracy, which is like the Christian version of Dream Theater, who I love.
Yeah there's actually some really good, they're really good progressive rock, progressive metal Christian bands. You know, there for a while, Tourniquet had kind of, they kind of went through a Dream Theater phase.
Yeah, they did. And it doesn't surprise me, Judd, that a man like you likes Dream Theater, because they're like what would you call them? They're like the technical, masters of music. A musician's band.
Yeah, it's definitely avant-garde progressive, probably.
What are we talking about here? I've never even heard of Dream Theater. I'm on Spotify.
Oh my god.
Well, you just have to catch up.
That works. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. that was the audio conjectural science conversation.
Interesting. Okay, back to giants and Nephilim and, you know, all the good stuff.
Uh, Well, it's sort of going off of the conjectural science drill that we were on. Astrobiology is what I bought. You know, this isn't something that you can test in a library, or excuse me, a laboratory. You can't really make direct observations about it. In the same way that you even have of new conjectural sciences like xenoarchaeology, you know, perspective archaeology on alien worlds. We're not, so far as we know, we're not at that point yet. And yet there have been papers written by, you know, NASA employees on, I forget the guy's name, but it was a couple of months ago I read a paper on xenoarchaeology, or exo or xenoarchaeology, the same thing.
Would a Demogorg be in that?
Good question. That's a hard from question. Demigorg. So
now
the
we're
creatures from Stranger Things.
Stranger, yeah, the creatures from Stranger Things. I guess they supposed they could. Those are all in addition to the Montauk stuff that, you know, they deal with in Stranger Things. I think all of those were Dungeons and Dragons monsters, if I'm not mistaken.
Do you think xenoarchaeology would include extra-dimensional travel as opposed to planetary travel? Do you think you could consider?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, again, within the realm of conjecture, yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
Okay.
So,
let's okay, conjecture, consmecture. All right. Come on, let's be honest. We think this stuff is real.
Yeah, for sure, dude. Like, man, there's so much I want to know about the Nephilim still. I mean, we've all, like, basics aside, you know, we still argue, like, I want to see one. I want to see a giant, but I don't want to see it up close, and I don't want to see it in Afghanistan, and I don't want to see it in the Congo.
I don't
want to see it on a mountain,
Bigfoot.
But somehow I want to see one. I want to see one, Judd.
Well, we all want the smoking gun, but probably not on our front doorstep, right?
What do you think about the mud fossils?
Would you believe it if you saw a video of it? I wouldn't. I mean,
I'll probably not.
I tend to take videographic evidence with a huge, you know, carton of Morton salt. Not just a grain, because so many of that, you know, even the photographic stuff and the videos, so many of that can be can just be doctored up. I'll automatically, you know, write off a good 80% of it is
so hoaxes. Here's the problem. If I go and I see it with my own eyes and I take a video and show you guys,
I wouldn't believe you.
Yeah, I wouldn't believe me either.
No, I think you're pulling my leg. So let me ask you this, Judd. Do you tend to follow reports worldwide of maybe giant activity? Do you think any giants are still, like, currently active, or do you primarily focus on just historical footprints?
Most of what I do, because I'm by training I'm a historian and anthropologist, so most of what I do is historical in nature, but I try and keep my finger on the pulse beat, so to speak, of, you know, potential modern sightings. And I don't know if compelling is the right word, but I do find anecdotes about, you know, finding, well, not, they're not necessarily anecdotes because they are archaeological finds, such as the tomb of Osiris and in 2003, right on the eve of the Iraqi invasion, the tomb of Gilgamesh was found. That story was quickly buried. You know, and I hear all kinds of things about, yeah, they found the body and it was in a incredible state of preservation and they shipped it out. And I've heard the stories about the Kandahar giant. And like I say, I try and keep my finger on the pulse beat of these modern sightings, but admittedly, most of my focus is on what's in the historical, the mythological, and the archaeological, anthropological records. The archaeological records, of course, in my opinion, having the most sparse evidence, but not necessarily vacant of evidence.
What's the time frame in your mind as to how long it was ago that they were still active in the United States. Like, how long has it been since they died out or left the United States, you know, compared to like now? What's the
Like, you mean like you're
like
talking
what's
about
the latest when you think say, they were running around here in the US?
Well, when you say United States, are you talking about like the continental, like yeah. North America?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think if we're to believe some of the accounts of like the conquistadors that that first went up like the Colorado River from the Baja Gulf into what would today be northern or northwest Mexico and into Arizona, you know, they talk about seeing giants in the 16th century. The same could be said for South America. There were also conquistadors that kept records of seeing giants in places such as Patagonia in the southern part of the continent. So I think, you know, in the scale of history, fairly recently, you know, to much people, to a lot of people's surprise, I would think.
Yeah, but that sounds about right. What do you think about some of the latest stuff talking about giants in the Grand Canyon or Egyptian culture of some sort in the Grand Canyon, but it also relates to giants?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, despite the push from mainstream academia, I think that, okay, let's start this way. We already know that there were explorers in the Americas before Columbus. I mean, even Columbus was using Basque sailors because they were the best navigators and they knew those waters and had likely already been to the coasts of North America. But even before that, you had the Norse, you know, Leif Erikson arriving in the late 11th century, or excuse me, the late 10th, early 11th century. So there were already old world explorers here well before Columbus. And there's good evidence to suggest that there were other peoples that had maritime cultures that were fully capable of doing it. The Chinese on the Pacific side, for instance, under the admiral of the Chinese Navy, Zheng He, beat Columbus by a good, you know, 50, 60 years. In the case of more antique or let's say medieval travelers, the Irish monk Brendan, St. Brendan, kept a record of his voyage, and some people have posited that was a voyage to the Americas. But more antique, and I think better evidence, lies with cultures like the Phoenicians, who were absolutely the finest mariners in the ancient world. They routinely went out of the Straits of Gibraltar. They were mining tin in Cornwall, England, for instance, and making voyages down the west coast of Africa. And of course, these routes and the kind of navigational technology that the Phoenicians would have been using, you know, that sort of thing diffuses into other cultures. And so, you know, peoples like the Egyptians would have picked up on that because they traded with the Phoenicians. Mm-hmm. So it's entirely within the realm of probability as far as I'm concerned. And there, you know, there's a laundry list of artifactual material spread all over the continent that bears a kind of mute testimony to the presence of these ancient visitors to North America.
Now, just because I'm not a history buff, and like how much of what you just said would be challenged by the mainstream?
Probably, you know, probably 75% of it.
Why though? Why would it be challenged? I mean, if there's good evidence for it, are there people out there that are looking at the same evidence and saying we're not drawing the same conclusion? Or like when I look at what kids learn and what I learned, that pretty much Columbus discovered the United States, even though it already had, we already had people here, you know, obviously. Why are we still pushing these narratives? What purpose does it serve?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's one that I ask all the time. In fact, I'm finishing a paper right now that I'm getting ready to submit for publication that deals with prehistoric civilization. And by prehistoric, I mean before the flood, essentially. These would have been civilizations before the classical ones like Mesopotamia and Egypt and the Indus River Valley that have historically, or I should say traditionally, been held as the earliest civilizations. Now, if we're to apply the criteria of what exactly it means to be a civilization, there are sites that go back much farther than that into the Mesolithic and the Neolithic that meet those criteria. Sites like Shatal Hayuk, sites like prehistoric Jericho, Tel Caramel in Syria. And you could even say that Göbekli Tepe was a kind of holy city. That one's the oldest one. It dates back to, you know, a conventional dating, depending on, you know, what dating you subscribe to. Dates back to the 11th millennium BC. Now, I've reviewed about 20 textbooks, world history, world civilization textbooks, and only two of those reference any of these, and it's usually just a sentence or two, and only one of them out of all 20 references Göbekli Tepe. Now, it's the same kind of logic. Why are these civilizations being treated as a kind of speed bump or not even being acknowledged as civilizations? They had stratification of society. They had a centralized government, specialization of labor. They weren't villages. They weren't mobile villages. They were sedentary. They meet all of the criteria of city-states and antique civilizations. And that's my question, is why these aren't just flights of fancy. They're not rhapsody. In the case of Göbekli Tepe, you've got 25 years of solid archaeological reports produced by a reputable archaeologist, Dr. Klaus Schmidt. In the case of Jericho, you know, Kathleen Kenyon literally wrote the book on most of the phases of the occupation of Jericho, from prehistory all the way to, the late Iron Age. So
like in your opinion.
Let me finish. Okay. What I'm saying is that, you know, there's solid scientific evidence in this case to amend an idea that's been traditionally held. And you could make the same argument for, you know, the Nephilim. The question is why exactly are they being peripheralized? Without waxing conspiratorial, my answer is, you know, it's hard to say, but it does seem that there's an agenda behind it.
Okay, that's a great segue.
Do you think it's, I don't want to say politically motivated, but big government motivated? Well,
that's exactly what my question is. Like, Tom Hart, like who's the gatekeeper to this? Like, when you're talking about other people not even wanting to acknowledge some of the possibilities, even if they're not committing mm-hmm. to this as a conclusion, who are we dealing with as a gatekeeper? Like Tom mentioned, are we talking about the political government? But when in history, like, you know a lot more about, like, you've gotten permits for doing digs in other places. Like, you were with Marzulli and Richard Shaw, rest in peace.
Indeed.
That, you know, in Peru, you know how things work with foreign governments when you're trying to dig or, you know, measure skulls, blah, 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 blah. Who are the gatekeepers when it comes to this? Who is controlling the flow of information?
Well, it is political. Archaeology in particular has historically been political and driven by political agenda. But as we all know, and your audience as well, it's also spiritual, because these sorts of things, if they were accepted, would give all the more credence, you know, to the biblical narrative. That's at the center of it. You ask why, that has to be at the center of it.
What do you think about, because this definitely would factor in. I've looked at it a little bit, but it's very confusing to me. But the idea of this, I don't know how much, I sent you links months ago about the Tartaria stuff, that there might have been an advanced empire, you know, that was from one end to the other, that was wiped out by some sort of calamity. We're not talking about antediluvian civilization. We're talking about post-diluvian civilization that rose to world superpower status. And a lot of people are saying that you can still see evidence of some of their architecture in cities with the way these buildings seem to be buried. And then repurposed, and then we've got all this new architecture around it. Like, there's enough there as I've watched these videos. I'm like, that's actually really interesting. And some of these really old maps seem to indicate Tartaria wasn't just located in some portion of Russia, but that there might have been elements of something called Tartaria worldwide. Somebody was telling me that Nikolai Tesla, admitted to being one of the last Tartarians, and that his ability to, you know, create technology that we still are somewhat confused about was, you know, remnant residual knowledge that he gained from. So anyway, all of that, I don't know how much of that you've heard or not, but like, I don't know if you looked at it, but how plausible is it that we could have kind of wiped a central superpower that would have played a role in the midst of history that could have made all this other stuff confusing? You know, like there's a big piece missing out of the middle because somehow we've altered the history books to avoid it. Does that make sense? Is that possible?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, that as you were talking, particularly if this is a Central Asian, you know, a Russian, you know, lost civilization, as you were talking, I immediately thought of J.P. Mallory in his book, The In Search of the Indo-Europeans, and an archaeologist by the name of Vere Gordon Child, who was partially the inspiration for Indiana Jones. But both of these guys wrote extensively on Central Asian ancient culture, you know, the great horse cultures like the Scythians and the Sarmatians. And it was from this cluster of cultures that most of the European and Asian languages sprang from. In other words, you could take words, you know, from these disparate cultures and find a kind of connective tissue. Like, for instance, yoke in English. A yoke is something that you harness animals with, right? Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's also delicious when you crack one open.
Yes, that's YOLK. I'm talking about.
Okay. I'm hooked on phonics, bro. I'm just hooked on phonics.
I figured you knew, but I didn't want to talk about, you know, harnessing plow animals with scrambled eggs. But
I didn't want to play my ignorance card, but I was just focusing on making jokes out of sounds. Hey, not spellings.
It works. We've chased some rabbits. That's okay. It's all right. But yeah, you take a word like yoke in English, it's related to yugam in Latin and yoga in Sanskrit. Okay. So there's the latter two basically being, you know, discipline or study. So you've got this sort of connective tissue with that word. You know, you can do this with all kinds of words because they spring, you know, theoretically, they spring from the same clusters of peoples migrating throughout the parts of Asia. You've got the Vedic peoples that invade India, northern India, in about 1500 BC, and then you have other groups branching off that became the proto Greeks, the Minoans and Mycenaeans and the Greeks, and then you had and then you have groups, you know, that become the Romans and the Celts and whatnot. You know, it's highly possible that there are elements of that lost civilization in the languages of the old world, including English. Because so many of the languages of Europe and Asia historically, linguistically descended from this early group of languages. But that's an interesting proposition.
I'm not the mud flood guy, you know, when it comes to the research. And some of it seems skeptical at best. But when I'm looking for some pictures right now, because there are so many people looking at historical pictures and maps that I'm almost inclined to be open to the idea.
Yeah.
That, okay, hear me out on this. Okay. And I'm just getting really weird right now. Okay. Cause I've really, like, let's just say that we had another world superpower that called itself Tartaria. Okay. we know in our history books that somehow that was like a pre-Russian people. Like it was like early Russian, right? If like in modern day textbooks, if we were to talk about Tartarians, we're talking about Russia, right? You think, mm-hmm. right? Is that true?
Yeah, well, I guess hypothetically you could call them that. The reason that they were called, you know, the peoples from the steppes of Asia were called the Tartars is because the Europeans thought that they were from Tartarus. They were from hell, which is also kind of interesting if you think about it.
That is interesting. So, okay. Where was I going with this? Because it's a weird train of thought. Okay. So yeah. Hypothetically, I've just wondered if it's possible that somehow, just like you said, because we know at the heart of this stuff, it's spiritual, right, in nature. And ultimately, there's right. this war between the Watchers, the Fallen Watchers, and God Almighty. And somehow, you know, it'll make sense when we're there and we see how everything played out and we get all the facts. But, you know, you and I aren't necessarily privy to the facts, all the facts in this war that have occurred over thousands of years. But you see at Babel, a world superpower that rises up. You see rebellion against God. God crushes that, disperses people. And ever since then, you see these movements in history of trying to develop a world superpower. It's like the spirit of Antichrist is always present, trying to build a global power. Somehow, God thwarts it. It falls apart until the appointed time when we see prophecy fulfilled in the final days. And we see this one world superpower, and it's the ultimate ending, right, to this story that's playing out. But what if the angels are consistently changing their tactics in this war because they're still trying to win? And what if the Tartarian legends are true, then they had advanced technology, which Tesla would be proof of, along with other things that we have. They were advertising a chimeric animal as their flag. We know that they were steeped in animal-human hybrids, okay? They had like it was like a griffin, a lion-eagle thing, right? That's what they were advertising. We know that they were hell-bent on evil in just about everything that we're moving towards today, and they had achieved a world superpower status. Something happened, not a global flood. We're not talking about something that God promised would never happen. But something cataclysmic happened that annihilated them and caused a reset, okay? If that's true, then it's possible that the spiritual powers and principalities could change their tactic and for whatever reason have opted to start over and erase the last attempt for whatever reason to move people in a direction. I don't know. It just makes sense to me theoretically.
Here's something else for you to chew on. The Sumerians, the earliest of the Mesopotamians, were not actually indigenous to that part of the continent. The Shumer is the name that their northern Semitic neighbors, the Akkadians, gave to them. And so they were called the Sumerians, the Shumerians. Their indigenous name was the Kiangir, which meant something like the black-headed or black-eyed people. Because they were largely Indo-European. In their earliest part of the migration, they were from the area probably around, between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea, and made their way down and probably in their migrations probably intermarried with the Ubaid culture, which was a predecessor to the Mesopotamian culture at large, the antique Mesopotamian civilization. But the original Sumerians, the Kiangir, were actually not indigenous to that part. They came down there. They migrated down there from that area that I just spoke of, which would have made them part of that corpus of Proto-Indo-European peoples.
That's interesting. Only part of that went over my head, but
okay,
I kind of...
No, well, I mean, the long and short of it is that they, you know, the original Sumerians migrated from Central Asia, southern Central Asia, down into the area that we call Iraq today.
Oh, man, it's history is like, and we've talked about this. I remember I asked you one time, I was like, dude, what, like, how possible is it that every bit of history is fabricated, you know, like where it's all been twisted and perverted and nothing we know is true about history. And I remember you were just like, you just kind of looked at me kind of blankly for a second. You're like, well, then you're going to have a lot of sleepless nights. I was like, yeah. Yeah.
Are you talking about Mandela effect or?
No.
Oh,
I was just,
we've opened up a whole new can of worms now.
Okay. I'm going to cut that off.
Mandela aside, just revisionist history. Just like, if you are able to entertain the idea that these powers and principalities would affect our history textbooks to manipulate the next gen, because you can essentially eradicate your entire history in a single generation if you have tight enough control, right?
Sure.
One single generation of people, and you can eradicate everything we thought we knew. And that's my number one concern about digitizing everything is all it's going to take is one person in a position of power to make a final change on a digital copy of something, and then nobody has the original. You know, if all of the papers are gone, if all the books are gone, you could
reminds me of the movie AI, where they didn't even know what a human was anymore. But
yeah,
anyway, that's science fiction.
Or even Fahrenheit 451, where they burned all the books, and you had these people that memorized entire books. Yeah, and that's how they preserved the quote unquote wisdom of the ages.
Yeah, if they were counting on my memory, then they would be in bad shape.
Yeah, probably mine too.
That's why we need the giver. He just transfers memories.
I want to get your take on something, Judd. This morning I'm reading in Jeremiah, and I'm reading about, you know, what God's doing there. He's allowing judgment to come on Judah. He's appointed Jeremiah. He's like, you're my prophet. You're going to let the government know. You're going to stand up to all these people. Okay. And I just, every time I go back and I look at a slice of history, it's not much different from right now, but it repeats itself. There's nothing new under the sun. And I think about Francis Schaeffer, because Jared and I have been talking about this a lot on the show. Didn't predict the future, but he could figure out, okay, this was going to happen because he looked at the past and he was a historian. He understood, okay, this is where we're headed, and he nailed it. I'm telling you, he nailed it with some of very, you know, some things were almost identical, you know, that's happened in the past 10 years where he said things were gone. As an archaeologist, give me your equivalent, or is there a parallel? You know, I don't know. I mean,
in
fossils, that tells us that you're seeing patterns, you know, in history and where we're at right now. And I mention where we're at right now because it just seems crazy where we're at right now. I mean, I don't know if any of the three of us 5 years ago would believe that we would be, that the public at large, a good portion of them would be having a debate over, is gender, you know, fluid? Is there such a thing as boys and girls? I don't know if you understand my question, but I'm just wondering, have you seen any kind of patterns, you know, with archaeological evidence of this just kind of cycle repeating?
Well, you know, in my training as a historian, it always occurred to me that, you know, they talk about cycles of history and that, you know, there are patterns and kind of a, you know, you see proximate causes and distal causes, you know, things that create stimuli that you can immediately see. And then there are ones that create repercussions farther down the road. I suppose that's probably history or art, you know, any of the historical sciences, history or archaeology or anthropology. That's probably as close as we could come to being, you know, prognosticators of the future. But, you know, a careful eye can see those sorts of patterns in a different sort of way. Jared Diamond, who wrote the book Guns, Germs, and Steel, he's he's a biologist by training, but he's quite the ethnologist and historian. And I don't support he's completely evolutionary. So I don't really, you know, I don't subscribe to that paradigm, but he's really got a talent for what I just talked about, analyzing these proximate and distal causes. And his book leads up to the clash between the old world and the new world, with the arrival of the Spanish, specifically the conquest of the Inca by Pizarro. And he makes a really good case that it was all of these variables, like epidemiology and geography and the emergence of agriculture, you know, all of these variables that played a role. It wasn't just the superior technology, the guns and the steel, as it were, that led to the defeat of the Inca and a lot of the New World peoples, but it was the layout of the continents. You know, if you look at Eurasia, it's laid out, you know, laterally. It's long from east to west, so that made the spread of technology and agriculture and things, metallurgy and things like that, more easy because it was similar latitudes that they traveled over. And so that also meant that old world peoples had herd animals. You know, they had sheep and goats and pigs and cattle and horses and things like that. And so they were, you know, over these thousands of years, they were almost inoculated against, you know, things like anthrax and smallpox. You add all that together and you take it to the New World, to a population that was completely unprepared for it. And you have the conquest of the Americas. And it wasn't just the military conquest, but it was this sort of unconscious biological warfare. You know, the smallpox was especially virulent. And so in that way, he does a really good job of looking at all of these variables that stacked up against the people in the New World, just by looking at variables like, you know, geography, epidemiology, the emergence of agriculture, technology, the spread of those things along latitude lines. In the Americas, it didn't do that because it's long from north to south, and it had, you know, mountain ranges and different climates that those ideas would have had to have spread through. And so the deck was really sort of stacked against the Americas. Now, that was a mouthful, I know, but it does illustrate ways in which humanity scholars and social scientists, like historians and archaeologists, can look at patterns and see things down the road using these sorts of things. And, you know, a lot of people have done, you know, you mentioned Francis Schaeffer, not necessarily just historians, but, you know, H.G. Wells, you know, he, you know, sort of prognosticated a lot of the things that have come along too. There's an argument to be made that he may actually have been part of that, but, you know, that's probably for another discussion. But yeah, there are these patterns that recur in history, and there's wisdom in a simple proverb like there's nothing new under the sun, because that's true. It just gets repackaged and thrown out. When I took Christian history, church history, for the first time, I really started to think about what exactly a philosophy of history meant. And it's almost cliche to say that, you know, history is cyclical. It repeats itself. Well, yeah, it does, but, you know, it does in different ways. And so I quit thinking about history as a circle and more like a telephone cord. And the professor sort of poo-pooed the idea to begin with, but then he started really liking it. And I really started thinking about those kinds of things when I took church history, just in terms of philosophy of history. But again, I say all that just to say that, yes, I mean, you can see these patterns. You can see, for instance, you know, the downfall of Judah, and you can see very similar, or the northern kingdom of Israel before that, for that matter. You can see similar kinds of things happening within our own culture that are analogous to that. And you could almost look at it as a kind of a very complex algorithmic equation. You know, where you have these sets of variables, you're going to get these kinds of results. It's almost like cleometrics. You know, back in the 70s, historians sort of flirted with the idea that you could completely quantify and arithmetize history, you know, into basic statistical probability. Well, that sort of went to the wayside, but there's a little bit of, you know, there's some truth in that. You can see these patterns emerge and they produce similar results.
Fascinating. Yeah.
I listen to you talk about history and then I'm like, wow, I really don't know anything about how people study history.
Well, you can study with me through the Institute.
Calvin's Institutes?
No, the Institute of Biblical Anthropology, my friends.
When you have somebody like Judd who has a passion for what he does, it pulls you in a different way. You know what I'm saying? Like Judd could be, I hate math, but if he was a math teacher, I would want to be his student.
I appreciate that, Tom. I don't see that happening in the near future, but thank you.
If only all of your other students felt that way.
Hey, I beg to differ. Judd and I went out to eat, and we ran into one of his old students. And the student acted like he was starstruck, like Professor Burton. You know, they were so excited to see him.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, this dude is a local celebrity.
Well, Judd and I talk a fair amount on the phone, and I've heard some of the things he thinks about some of his students. So
those are good students, though. I remember that. I remember my good students. Yeah, I mean, let's just put it, I have all the patience in the world for somebody who wants to learn. I'll bend over backwards for them, but I have next to none for people that don't. Now, I'm sure you guys feel the same way. I mean, you run into it all the time with, you know, the material, you know, not just the material you cover, but the actual work that you guys are doing.
Okay, I want to break this up for just a second because I saw something on the internet in my studies and I need to get your opinion on it. It's a little off topic.
Okay.
Honest thoughts about this being 3D printed.
Is that a swashbuckling banana?
That's a banana in a suit of armor, dude. Tell me that's not why people made 3D printers. Tell me, Judley Burton. Tell me this is not why 3D printers exist. I think we all need these.
I am taken aback beyond my ability to articulate myself.
For history.
Now he's speechless.
Now, because you're creating the Institute for Biblical Anthropology, you have to think about ways to finance it. And I think one of the ways that we could do that is to create our own little 3D printed models of revisionist history. We could create.
Are you suggesting this should be the school mascot?
I think.
Are you guys going to have a polo team?
Something needs to be the mascot of the Institute of Biblical Anthropology. Am I right? Something has to be.
Are you thinking, you're talking about like, what do you want me to do? Sell action figures?
Well, I think action figures that are created and designed by us.
I would buy the Tom Dunn and Jared Crestman action figures.
Dude, okay. How do we sign up for this? That would be fun.
That would be awesome.
Did you know somebody made an action figure for Through the Black? Did you know that?
No kidding.
Watch, 3D printed. I'll get it.
I got it. I already beat him. Right here. We got.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
dude. Jared, what is? Is he on a mammoth? What is that?
It's a psychedelic elephant that's from one of our most popular shows that we did, and it is big.
That's awesome.
Bigfoot flashing the peace sign, wearing a beanie on a multicolored elephant. Tom and I are the only two people outside of maybe the original creators that have one. It's completely custom.
That is awesome. If I had that, it would be, thank you for the shot. Yes, that's great. If I had that, it would have a place of honor on my desk.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we're putting our elephants away, guys, This is Through the Black Uncensored on the Daily Renegade. And our website is throughtheblack.com, and our other website is realdarknews.com. Just to mention to this audience, we don't know who's out there. We know that we've been working with Josh Peck for a while and supplying him some shows, and we are happy tonight to share our Judd Burton show. Guys, we could have shared this with our main audience, but we chose Daily Renegade to share this. And I just want to mention, hey, we have a new news site, and it's called Real Dark News. And when you go on there and you copy the URL and then you share it, you tweet it, you tell your family, you tell anybody, we are very happy that you do that. So we're excited. We're trying to get some clicks on that site, and we need your help to do it. So anyway, Real Dark News is exactly what it sounds like, and we haven't really talked about it on this on this show. So thought I'd mention that. You got your elephant put away, Jared.
Yeah, we're good to go. But he's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Come on.
We're good. We're good. Are we? Is this? Was that the? Were you throwing it to me to wind it down, or were you winding it down?
Well, no. I'm just throwing it to you to ask a question, because that's how we usually do, is go back and forth.
Right.
We're coming up to the end of our hour. Zoom actually gave us some free time, but I don't think it's going to continue to give us free time. So, looks like we might have to pay for Zoom, Thomas Dunn.
It could be the case. It could.
When's
be
your YouTube channel going to start, Judd? When are you start doing putting content out there?
Again?
Your YouTube channel. When are you going to start putting content out there? Did you hear me?
That's for Judd. Can Judd hear
Okay, us? Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah.
Oh,
okay. Yeah.
Okay.
You're talking to me? Talking to me about YouTube content?
When is your YouTube channel coming out where you start putting out content on your YouTube channel?
Imminently. I'm working on that. I've got the account set up, and the first... actually, when I get off the video here today, I'll be writing the first transcript for the first Beyond report.
When you want to talk about the great banana wars of 1630, you let me know. Okay? Because I feel like I would make an excellent first guest for your YouTube channel.
You will be the first. You're at the front of the line in the loop.
You have professors lining up for miles to talk to me about what I've discovered historically. We will conjecture nauseam.
If you think they discount 75%, you just wait till this show.
And we will use very large words back and forth. And you will spell yolk, and I will spell yolk, and people will be in awe of our intellectual prowess.
Hey, Judge, since Jared's not going to... Since he doesn't seem to be shutting this down, I have another question for you.
Sure. Hit me.
How do you have a teaching or a technique, strategy, whatever, that you use? Because we're talking about belief in Nephilim and all this stuff, and it could just be the gospel in general. Do you have something... that you use that's, I don't want to say it's 100% foolproof, but where you can shift paradigms? Like, how do you reach people that, you know, that you see something that you see work over, you know, over and over more often than not?
Sure. Well, particularly if they're coming from a more naturalistic worldview, you know, or something that's outside the realm of a Christian worldview, that's generally a good place to start, you know. And so in the case of something like the Nephilim, I would start with, you know, the academic history that I had, which, you know, you could essentially consider that, you know, let's just whittle it down to the church documents in the first three centuries of the history of the church. You know, the early church fathers talk extensively about these beings. In the teaching materials that they produced, and you know, you could, that corpus of documents within the historical context, is a kind of intellectual history, and so, you know, if I were talking to somebody you know, like a colleague who was trying to wrap their mind around this or something, or you know, just anybody, if they're read, you know, and that sort of thing, you know, if they've read church documents or they're interested in religion or something like that, then that's the place where I usually start and get them to thinking about that. And if the conversation progresses, you know, if the Holy Spirit leads it that way, then of course, you know, the salvific issues come up, and it becomes a testimony. It becomes a ministerial tool. But yeah, I try to meet people where they're at. I think that's a very Pauline, you know, approach. Is just to, you know, try and meet people where they're at, and then let the Holy Spirit, you know, guide you and draw them in.
What are some of the best church fathers to read, early church fathers, patristic literature, that was some of your favorite when it comes to studying giants?
Yes.
All of it.
All of it. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, you have, because it's difficult to, you know, find a document that's altogether devoted to, you know, the fallen angels or the watchers, because
right, it's so ingrained in their belief system that it comes out in little ways throughout their teaching.
Right. It's a chapter here, you know, it's a book there, you know, it's always a passage, you know, so it's, you know, I half jokingly answered yes, but I'm also being serious in the fact that, you know, virtually all of them, whether they actually believed in it or not, which, you know, most of the early ones did, or, you know, they subscribed to some other, you know, theory, like the, you know, they were Sethites or humans or something like that. You know, they referenced that material.
I've never really read any patristic literature whatsoever. I'm barely getting into the Puritans, you know, like the Puritans of from our private conversations that, you know, between Edwards and guys like Thomas Watson and, you know, even as far up as, well, Jonathan Edwards, and then later on, you know, like Charles Spurgeon, who, you know, developed out of a Puritan library of sorts. You know, I'm not, there's so much to read there. I haven't really even gone back further past like Calvin, right? Sure. Or John, like a John Owen. So how easy would it be? Because I don't know how much literature we're talking about, but how easy would it be to compile sort of a comprehensive collection of patristic literature that was, you know, centered on their teachings about the giants in one way or the other? Like, if you just compiled everything together, how big of a book would that be, and how much time would that take? Just to like make it available to people that were just like, you said, even if it's not.
I've actually got that on my to-do list. It's one of the projects that I'm going to be doing now.
How much effort does that take? With current tools and technology.
With technology, it's a lot easier, you know, because so much is, you know, virtually all the patristic literature is digitized, and virtually all of it is translated. I mean, there's some higgly piggly stuff, you know, that's out there, but
is that a technical term?
That's a technical. That means that Dr. Burton would have to use his Greek skills and translate them himself.
Okay.
But most of, you know, the 95% of it has been translated, and it's most of it's public domain. It's a very doable project. You know, it would probably just take a few months to put it together and put some commentary to it. And like I said, I mean, I've already got an outline for a book just like that.
Interesting.
So look for the Institute Presses to be putting that out in the next probably year or two.
Cool, man. We still need to do some shows on Edwards.
Yes, we've got to do the Edwards series.
I've dropped the ball on that just because I've been traveling. Tom's been traveling. It's hard enough for Tom and I to get together to do shows. And then, you know, and then we love doing like random shows for the Daily Renegade, because it's like fun to do Through the Black Uncensored. But then I jumped on and I started doing another show with a guy named J. Brett Prince, where we've been going through Thomas Watson's A Godly Man Picture. So I jumped on that, and that's every Thursday over at his channel on The Good Ground. And so we've been trying to introduce Puritan literature that way. But I still want to do the Jonathan Edwards thing. I just haven't had time to wrap my mind around it lately because I haven't been reading as much Jonathan Edwards, which, dude, I ran into some quotes from Martin Lloyd-Jones. You know, I had like an interesting experience the other day where I was talking to a friend who was explaining who his favorite Puritans were when it came to, you know, private reading, personal reading. And I brought up Edwards, and he was just kind of, he kind of like wasn't into Edwards, you know. It was just like, nah, you don't, you know, this is where you need to be at. And I was like, dude, I don't know how you say that. Like, Edwards has changed my life more than any other author ever outside of scripture, you know. And and it was interesting talking to him. And then I was reading Martin Lloyd-Jones, and Martin Lloyd-Jones was like, Jonathan Edwards changed my life. Read his books, study his books. And I really, really have so much respect for Martin Lloyd-Jones. And to hear him go on and on about how life-changing Edwards is, dude, he just flooded me with security again. Like, I got to get Edwards out there. I got to keep pushing. I haven't written in a while. Like, I wrote like 7 or 8 chapters of that book, and then I've gotten tied up with other projects, and I haven't gone back to writing. But I need to get back in because, I don't know. I think introducing people to distinguishing works of a mark of the true spirit of God is important.
Yeah, we talked about doing a 3-part series or something on Jonathan Edwards and just the Puritan influence in general in colonial America. Yeah, I'm all for it. Let's do it. Just whenever you have time.
You're going to have to primarily be the brain on that one because I do not have time. But I want to learn. What's the format of that going to be? Are we going to get together and you're just going to teach me and I can ask questions and all the commentary?
Well, I thought maybe the first episode we could do an overview of the late 17th, early 18th century colonial America and talk about the cultural religious milieu of the time. And then just sort of gradually get more specific, you know, over the next 2 episodes. I would sort of start off, and then I would pass the torch to you in the second episode or something.
I'm gonna have to read Under the Cope of Heaven again.
I think I recommended that book to you, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's a good book. I also found who is it? Why can't I think of his name? The guy from Banner of Truth. He's affiliated with Banner of Truth. He's apparently written one of the most amazing biographies about Edwards. I bought one that apparently wasn't the best one to buy, but I bought it on Audible. So I'm looking forward to reading his too. It's really a daunting task though to provide commentary on Edwards for me because I see Edwards is like so far up here, like. Every time I read if I read 2 pages out of like Religious Affections, if it's like the right 2 pages, I feel like I have to think about it the rest of the day. I can't read more because I have to digest and think about what I just read. And it's
Edwards is, he's pretty dense. Yeah. It's, he was a singular individual. I mean, outside of just being a godly man, he was an amazing scholar.
And it's not so much that like what he says is so hard. It's, you know, sometimes he's difficult to read, but sometimes he's not difficult to read, but the weight of his words are so heavy and it stimulates so much new thought for me.
Yeah.
Things I haven't thought about that I read 2 or 3 pages and I have to put the book down so I can just think about it. I'm like, okay, what does this mean for this? What does it mean for that?
Yeah. You're talking about a guy who wrote his sermons out and basically read them, you know, in this kind of monotone voice, but it was the weight of the message that would have people, you know, crying and wailing and repenting in the pews, you know, this kind of stuff happened with regularity, under his parsonage, you know.
You know, you saying that, I heard something very interesting from, I can't remember his name for some reason. I wish I could. He's very, you would know who he was the second I mentioned him. But there was a conference that was held by John Piper on Edwards, and all of the speakers that came were Edwardsian scholars, right? Mm-hmm. And, or at least contemporary Edwards scholars. And one of them, in one of his lectures, said something so interesting. He said that he's not convinced that Edwards was as monotone as myth and legend would have us believe now. And he quoted some of the personal writings of people that are no names, whose writings survived, that listened to Edwards preach, and they said he spoke quietly but with conviction. And I thought that was such an interesting point that he made, that Edwards wasn't dry. He was quiet, and he might have been somewhat quiet, but his words dripped with passion and fervor. And they talked about how compelling he was as a speaker, even if he wasn't violent at the podium. And I was like, you know, that's the first time I've ever heard that. And I actually meant to ask you if you'd heard similar, but there are people that wrote about having sat through his sermons, talked about how passionate he was.
Well, there's no reason to think that he was monotone all the time. That seems to be the prevailing idea.
It is. Yeah. It is the prevailing opinion. I never encountered anybody else that said something different. So I was just curious. Just interesting.
Yeah, you know, either way you dice it, you know, whether he was monotone or just soft-spoken, I mean, the gravity of his sermons and writings is just, it just knocks you. Like you say, you really have to take a little bit in and digest it.
Very true. And just when, like, the other day I was feeling really disparaged. I'm like, how can I write a commentary about this book? I need to just stop writing this book. This is stupid. You know, I can't write about Edwards. He's too lofty. But then I found out, and I'm not tooting my own horn at all. Don't hear a humble brag at all. It was just encouraging that Calvin's first book was a commentary on a book he read. And I was like, man, if that was a place where Calvin started, I mean, certainly it could be a
sure.
place where I start writing, I guess. Maybe that's the easiest transition, is you're just commenting on somebody else's thoughts. So it's much easier, you know, to generate a structure and a bulk of work, you know, because you're really just piggybacking on somebody else's brain. So,
well, I mean, we all, you know, we learn from somebody. We learn from a collection of somebody's, you know, you could say that a lot of what I do is commentary. But anyway, yeah.
But brilliant.
Yeah, it's a great place to start. I think there need to be more books that popularize thinkers and preachers like Edwards. You know, he was such a, you know, he was the lifeblood in a lot of ways of the Great Awakening, which was one of the four main cultural institutions that led to the American Revolution.
Yeah.
Along with, you know, the Enlightenment movement, the value of education in the colonies, and, you know, really the forge, you know, the last part of the finishing of the sword, so to speak, was the French and Indian War.
Do you think there were giants in the United States when Edwards was alive?
Probably not. You know, there was a lot of conjecture, though, about what was in the interior of the continent and what lay west. You know, Jefferson and Franklin and some of the other prominent thinkers of the day still believed that, and a lot of them, not just those two, believed that the, you know, somewhere in the interior of the North American continent, the woolly mammoth was still alive. You know, that was one of the things that Lewis and Clark were given standing orders to keep an eye out for. But that's another discussion. There was all kinds of high strangeness that
ended in a whodunit, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I got a collab that I think you'll jump at quicker than any other one.
Let's do it.
All right.
You and me talking about Christian heavy metal, like,
oh, man,
type stuff.
How much time do we have?
you will drop five projects to do that, I think.
Yep,
man.
Yep. I would do immediately. I would write a cultural study on Christian heavy metal. That would give me the greatest excuse to go interview all these guys and see their concerts.
And I still wouldn't be able to hang.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite? Who's your favorite of all time? Who's the GOAT? Christian metal.
It's almost cliche, but I got to go with Stryper.
I thought you were a Stryper guy, because I've heard you talk about Stryper a lot, but.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I played guitar, and I, you know, back in the day I was, you know, I played in heavy metal bands, and a lot of what we played was Stryper. So.
Legit, bro.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Judd. I'm glad you can make it tonight. I'm glad I can make it tonight. I'm glad Tom was more than anybody able to make it tonight. Because he's never been on, not because he backs out, but because he's never been on this show with us before.
Yeah.
It's never been a you, me, and Tom. It's been a you and me a lot. There's never been a you, me, and Tom. So I feel like Tom has been the missing piece to a fantastic show.
I have been.
Yeah, I have been. Absolutely.
Guys, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
I feel like Tom feels more like the guest tonight than Jed does.
let this be the first of many outings of the Three Musketeers.
Well, as long as we can schedule it, you're always welcome.
Well, I've got more flexibility now, so definitely.
How do people find Judd? How do they find the school? How do they find? Tell us. How do they get in touch with you? What you're doing?
There's a special compass that you have to order. And a map. No, you can find me at burtonbeyond.com. You can also go to the Institute of Biblical Anthropology webpage. It's tioba.org. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook.
Can you explain the school real quick so people understand? Because we didn't get really a chance to talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Institute of Biblical Anthropology is sort of like the way that I've explained it is it's Sunday school meets the X-Files. So it's the Orthodox stuff, and it's also kind of the fringe stuff too. But I'm interested in the, you know, the spectrum of the biblical world in all its supernatural wonder. And there are a number of elements of it. The one that we have going right now, again, the Sons of God Conference is an outgrowth of that we have every year. I also teach classes in biblical anthropology. People can actually sign up for individual classes, or they can do the whole run of courses called the apprenticeship, which I'm actually offering for $200 right now. People can take all 10 modules for $200. I've had all kinds of great students, homemakers, illustrators, even NASA engineers have taken classes from me. The long-term goal, of course, is to have the brick and mortar up and running probably within the next couple of years, but the online element will always be there. And of course, there's the research end of it, the fellowship, if you will, that will not only be involved in these kinds of book projects that I've been talking about, but also prospectively within the next few years, all kinds of expeditions.
Exciting stuff, folks.
Yeah.
This is cool, man. I'm glad to see you face to face and talk to you again, brother.
Yeah, me too, Tom.
A good time down there in on the border. And it's been too long, man. So,
hey, what's your favorite Striper song?
Favorite Striper song is probably, All for One off the Against the Law album. Go ahead.
We can't be censored, so I'm gonna play it out for you.
Yeah.
All right, Studley Judley, thanks for being on Through the Black over here at the Daily Renegade. YouTube can't censor us, so we're gonna send you out with a bang. Until next time, brother.
A headbang at that.
Brother, until next time. Thanks for being on Through the Black. Peace out, everybody. Subscribe.